It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, professional golf in the U.S. is coming under heavy criticism for an announced merger with a competing golf league backed by Saudi Arabian money. A Marquette sports law professor will take us through the legal and ethical controversies surrounding the change. Now, Donald Trump last week became the first ever former or sitting president to face federal criminal charges over his alleged misuse of federal documents and obstruction of an investigation into those documents. Trump made his first appearance in the case in a Miami courtroom earlier today. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this first criminal case against an American president? How do you feel about federal officials' investigation into Trump's withholding of classified documents? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
Can you bring us through the process that led up to these indictments, the appointment of a special counsel, the grand jury? What got us here?
What got us here was a discovery sometime after Donald Trump left office, when it was discovered that there were documents at the Mar-a-Lago that potentially needed to be returned. At least at that stage, there were concerns about whether classified or top secret materials. And the Justice Department contacted Donald Trump, contacted his attorneys and said, we believe there are some documents there that you're no longer entitled to hold, or they're in an unsecured place. And that really was the start of a back and forth conversation, at least according to the criminal indictment that we had filed against Donald Trump, that really starts back in 2021, that obviously has, at least for now, culminated in the indictment and the arraignment today. But what appears to have happened over about a two-year period is that there were numerous requests, allegedly requests to Donald Trump and his attorneys for certain documents. At some point, there was denial that there were any documents. At some point, some documents were returned. There was eventually a search warrant of the Mar-a-Lago to try to retrieve others. So this has been part of a ongoing, let us say, investigation and dialogue, again, of which really starts up not too far after he had left office, and really surrounds both the fact that or as the allegations are, that he's not authorized to have these documents, and these documents, which in some cases are sensitive or top secret materials, are in an unsecured location, unapproved by the Defense and Justice Department.
Let's talk about whether Trump was supposed to have these documents. I want to give a listen to former Trump administration Attorney General Bill Barr speaking about that on Fox News back on Sunday.
He was totally wrong that he had the right to have those documents. Those documents are among the most sensitive secrets that the country has. They have to be in the custody of the archivist. He had no right to maintain them and retain them. And he kept them in a way at Mar-a-Lago that anyone who really cares about national security, their stomach would churn at it.
Can you talk about what former Attorney General Barr had to say there? These things aren't supposed to be out of federal custody, in effect.
You're absolutely correct. Is that while as President of the United States, Donald Trump was entitled to see these documents, he may have even been entitled to declassify them, although there's some debate, you know, on that issue, but we won't get into that here. But he had access to them. But once you leave office, you no longer are entitled to these government documents. Personal papers, perhaps, yes. But government documents, no, especially documents that are classified as, again, confidential, secret, top secret. But it certainly doesn't matter. These are the property of the United States government. So that's one broad issue. The second broad issue is about where they were kept. This is what Bob Barr, Attorney General Barr, was talking about, is the sense that once, if these are materials that are classified or confidential, they have to be stored in an appropriate location that is secure against anybody just sort of walking in, grabbing them, seeing them. One of the worst nightmares that, let us say, the Defense Department can have is not knowing who has seen perhaps battle plans or who has seen top secret information. In effect, not knowing who knows what that we don't know about. And so that's what Barr is talking about here. It's both not only was the president, as an ex-president, no longer entitled to have these documents, but two, even if, just for the sake of argument, even if he were entitled to do so, he had them in an unsecure, unapproved location at the Mar-a-Lago.
Since this first became a story, we had former Vice President Pence reveal that he had some documents he wasn't supposed to. He volunteered that info, returned them. Biden, now President Biden, from his term as vice president, also had some. He volunteered that info, brought in people for a search. There have been questions about, okay, why is Donald Trump being indicted, not those two? And one key thing here seems to be the word willfully in the relevant law. Do you have these documents on purpose? Are you concealing them from the federal government? Can you compare and contrast the Trump case versus the Biden and Pence cases?
Sure. For first, let's just start with a basic premise here that to convict somebody of a crime, you not only have to show factually they did something, but you have to show intent. You have to show perhaps willful or deliberate, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of a general preposition of American law. But specifically, let's look at one of the laws he's being charged with, which is part of the Espionage Act. And it's the willful retention of national defense information. And the emphasis is upon willful here, because unlike Biden, unlike Pence, when it was discovered that they had the material, by accident they had this, they fully cooperated with the FBI. They turned over materials. They did not impede in any way the investigation or the return of the materials. The criminal indictment against Donald Trump basically says this is willful, also pointing to the fact, which is why there's also charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice. They're showing that what? That he made a choice to do so. And additionally, the law says not only do you have to make a willful choice, but it's also documents in a unsecure, unapproved location. And many of us have seen those pictures in the last few days of what? Boxes stacked up, and was it like bathrooms and stuff like that? But that's a really important distinction to understand here. It's about the intention. And if, again, if the criminal complaint is correct in terms of them laying out at least preliminarily some of the evidence, it's clear that Donald Trump, again, according to the indictment, knew that he was not supposed to have these documents. And in fact, some of the most damning evidence against him is from his former attorneys, where he tried to get him to, again, allegedly to lie or to deny there were documents or say there was no more. So that's a critical difference, what he did in terms of once the documents were discovered.
Talking to David Schultz with Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School, looking at the indictments against former President Donald Trump in this federal case over executive branch documents. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A former President Trump, David, has said, hey, this is political. This is a Democratic administration targeting a Republican predecessor and future Republican competitor in the next election, potentially. How do you see the chain of command? Is it insulated enough from political interference to defend against charges from the former president and supporters in Congress?
Two responses to that. First, that this was insulated, where apparently Joe Biden had no involvement in this. This was what? Something decided by the Justice Department, but more importantly, by careerists who are in the Justice Department who are prosecutors. So this was fairly insulated. But second, if this had been anybody else except for an ex-president who had material such as this, perhaps maybe a Julian Assange or somebody else, this would be treated equally as seriously in terms of the fact that what? We have secret information, documents about U.S. security, about defense policy, out and disclosed by unauthorized persons in an unauthorized locations. And again, we've seen over the last few years stories about that. Again, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning. We have a recent story also, I'm forgetting the name of the person off the top of my head, who was charged with disclosure of military secrets. So ordinary people would be treated just as harshly as this.
Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University of Law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the federal indictment of former President Trump over the alleged willful possession of classified documents and alleged obstruction of the investigation into those documents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the charges against the former president? What questions do you have? What do you hope comes out of this? What do you fear comes out of this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with University of Minnesota Law Professor David Schultz about the federal indictments of former President Donald Trump over his handling of secret documents. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have about the process here, the charges against the former president, what happens next, and what do you think about these indictments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. David, we had the former president appear in this federal court in Miami today, pleading not guilty to the charges. What happens next?
Well, what happens next at this point is a little bit of what was happening today. Besides the plea at this point, there was probably some, again, we didn't have a lot of information about what happened in court. There was probably some original scheduling orders. And what I mean by scheduling orders is that the judge and the attorneys have to agree to a variety of different things at this point, agree to things like depositions, exchanging of evidence, timelines on a whole bunch of different things. But what we can probably look forward to seeing over the next few weeks will be the Trump attorneys trying to get the charges dismissed, maybe trying to get some evidence thrown out. And then we should be thinking about very shortly, probably a trial date is going to be set. And the federal prosecutors would like to have a sooner as opposed to a later prosecutor or a trial date. Perhaps Trump might want to push it out, maybe push it out till after the election. But assuming for the sake of argument, the trial occurs when I think it's going to occur. And I say, I think, we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. It would be approximately, let's say, 12, 13 months out. If my counting is correct at this point, we could very well see this trial take place sometime in July or August of 2024, maybe a little bit later, which would put us at the tail end of the primaries around the time of the Republican convention, or depending on exactly the location of time, maybe as the general election is starting at this point. So this is going to be a trial that's going to be dead center into the 2024 presidential election cycle.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Jeff?
Yes, I was curious. I look at some of my friends who are Trump supporters, and they make the claim that, well, this is a two-tiered system of justice. To be fair, if you look at the former case with Secretary Hillary Clinton, she was in possession of government documents, of which were destroyed with, what I believe, was a bleach bit software to in effort to clean the servers, and destruction of government property in the forms of Blackberries and the cell phones with those government documents on them. I mean, he has a point. Is there a two-tiered system of justice?
Jeff, thanks for the call. David, I brought up the Pence and Biden examples as a little closer. These are all items that were on servers. The Hillary Clinton case, though, our caller wondering why wasn't she ultimately charged in that?
Well, there does seem to be evidence that she was cooperating, that again, it wasn't in the same kind of, let's say, willful way that Donald Trump is being charged. And for her, I will concede and say there were some problems there. There were some problems at the end of the day in terms of questions that may have never been resolved. However, having said that, even if she should have been charged but was not, the fact of the matter is that the Justice Department here has evidence of what they believe is a crime and are prosecuting in this case. And you can't really sort of make the argument and say other people weren't prosecuted for doing something wrong, and therefore I shouldn't be prosecuted.
Thanks for the call. Carly joins us now in Kewaunee. Carly, hello.
Hi, hello.
What did you want to bring up, Carly?
Well, kind of going off of what Jeff was just saying, but, like when Trump says that this is all, a conspiracy and we're out to get him, and I have people that, and then obviously the people that support him want to repeat that, and they believe it, and they think that this is all just a witch hunt and blah, blah, blah. But there's the whole justice system. How do you explain that means that everyone who put together the indictments and got the jury and the judges and all the people, do they imagine them sitting around going, yes, we're all on the same page. We'd like to take him down, even though this is wrong. How can we explain to say that there is literal evidence? And if people, we've seen how up in arms people got about her emails, you would think people would have tried to get her an indictment. There's probably people that tried to get her indicted and they couldn't because there was no evidence to do so.
Carly, thanks a lot for the call. I think Carly getting David to confidence in the system that led to these indictments.
I think she makes a good point here, but again, I'll come back and make the argument and say that if we read the criminal complaint, if we read what appears to be the evidence right now, Trump knew he was not supposed to be in possession of these documents, obstructed the FBI and the Justice Department effort to do an investigation, obstructed them in terms of trying to get documents returned. They had to get a search warrant to go get these documents, even after he said they didn't exist. And if you look at, again, the criminal indictment, it appears that he tried to get his attorneys to lie about all of this stuff. Granted, we have a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. But the fact that there seems to be the existence that he did have documents that he was not entitled to possess. He had documents in a location that was not authorized to hold those documents. We do have evidence of an underlying crime here that eventually a jury is going to have to decide if he's guilty. But that's how I think the Justice Department would respond, is to say it's not a witch hunt. There is a basis. Had the president or ex-president returned all these documents, had he not done all these different things, we wouldn't have an indictment now. The Justice Department's argument would be to say that Trump brought these problems on himself, much in the same way that Attorney General Barr made those comments, I think, this past Sunday on national television.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Marianne now in Kirtle. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I just have one comment. I read the entire indictment, and I suggest that everybody do the same, first of all. Second of all, three lawyers, all Trump lawyers, and two employees of Donald Trump rolled on him, and basically he was playing hide-and-go-seek with 80 boxes of documents that were everything from needing a special place to even view them all the way down to confidential. So how dare he plead not guilty? And that's my comment.
Marianne, thanks for the call. And yeah, reading the indictment, David, there's a lot of movement of these documents, sometimes concealed, according to the indictment, concealed from some of Trump's own lawyers before they got a look at them. How important do you think that series of evidence of that hide and seek, as Marianne says, will be in this case?
I think it's going to be very critical. I think also what's going to be critical is going to be the potential testimony of his former attorneys, where there appears to be notes and conversations where he's telling them at some point, what if we just say that no documents exist? Or tell them we've returned them all and so forth like that. And that's going to be important, because that information, his conversations with his attorneys, are going to be allowed into court or potentially allowed into court. And that becomes some of the strongest evidence, as well as the fact, as the caller pointed out, that documents were moved around in what appears to be an evidence to either obstruct justice or hide the documents from the FBI or the Justice Department.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute and a half or so, David, the judge who will preside over this case, at least currently planned Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, which doesn't always mean much. She was viewed as being sympathetic to the former president in early stages of this investigation. Your thoughts on Judge Cannon and this case?
Well, it may be at least initially good for the Justice Department to have perhaps a Trump appointee, because it's going to be a little bit harder for Donald Trump to claim she's biased, that she is out to get him when he appointed her. And in an earlier ruling, she was ruling in his favor. Now, how this plays out going down the line, I don't know, because again, we know that she was overturned, by a higher level of courts and some other issues down the line here. But it's going to be interesting to see how a Trump appointee handles this case going forward. I'm not expecting at this point to see either side ask her to recuse herself, take herself off the case. But I wouldn't rule that out as a possibility down the line, but I think it's a remote one.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you for the callers.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He joined us for a look at the federal charges against former President Trump over his possession of classified documents. Trump appeared in a federal court in Miami earlier today, kicking off this process. You can keep sharing your thoughts and follow the story online on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we'll have reporting from our colleagues at NPR online at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, this will be fun. It's rhubarb season. Get some advice on cooking and baking with the seasonal favorite. I've got a rhubarb plant planted by previous owner at my house. It is very productive. I've got a bunch already in the freezer. Looking for more advice on what to do with it. Now, if you have a favorite rhubarb recipe, get that conversation started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your rhubarb advice, recipes, or questions. Then join the conversation with Kate and her guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. If you're a nerd of a certain age, like me, you may have fond memories of the first video game console system you ever used. For me, that was the Atari 2600 with those cartridges that chunked into the system. Lots of consoles have come and gone since then. They stopped making official games for the 2600 back in 1990. But if you're still hanging on to your old console, good news, Atari is releasing a new game with one version on a cartridge made for the 40-year-old machines. As reported at Engadget, the new game is Mr. Run and Jump, and it's going to be released on a number of platforms, including Atari 2600 cartridge. Company says they're doing that in order to highlight, quote, the enduring capabilities of the 2600 hardware, even four decades after its initial release. Plus, I'm guessing they get some publicity for their new game. My old Atari, lost to the ages. I'm not going to hustle out to find one that still works. Got a lot of memories of Space Invaders, Pitfall, and more. It's an older system, but it checks out. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A U.S. Senate committee has opened an investigation into the announced merger of the PGA Tour and its competitor, LIV Golf. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut opened the inquiry, raising concerns about LIV Golf being owned and operated by the public investment fund managed by the Saudi Arabian government. He and other critics of the merger cite Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11 and the assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, along with human rights issues. When the two golf leagues were competitors, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan joined in the rebuke of the Saudi involvement in LIV Golf. But now he says the merger will help grow the sport and better compensate the players with new money invested.
I recognize that people are going to call me a hypocrite. And anytime I've said anything, I said it with the information I had at that moment And I said it based on someone that's trying to compete for the PGA Tour and our players. And so I accept those criticisms, but circumstances do change. And I think that, you know, in looking at the big picture and looking at it this way, that's what got us to this point.
Monahan sent a letter to Congress last week telling lawmakers they didn't do enough to support the PGA Tour and fending off LIV Golf from taking over the sport. The controversy surrounding the merger, which has not yet been finalized, is leading to broader conversations about the geopolitics surrounding sports and some of the legal issues, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this planned merger between the PGA Golf Tour and LIV Golf? If you're a fan of professional golf, how do you think it could affect the sport? If you're not a golf fan, how do you feel about Saudi Arabia's increasing involvement in a major U.S. sport? Do you think Congress or federal antitrust regulators should try and stop this deal? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew Mitten is a professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Pleasure to join you.
Well, this was a big twist, Matt. These were competitors to the death, it looked like, for a moment. Legal disputes, antitrust actions, international accusations flying here. Now they're best of friends at a merger. Were you surprised at how quickly this turned around?
Yeah, very much so. It's, you know, relatively rare and might be unprecedented where two parties and, you know, fight to the death, antitrust litigation, agree to a merger and resolving it. I can't really think of anything similar in recent years off the top of my head.
Let's talk about the antitrust part of this. This is one of the big legal issues. Now, LIV Golf, the Saudi Arabian-backed golf outfit, was going to challenge PGA for retaliating against golfers who left that tour, went over to LIV Golf, in part under antitrust law. Okay, well, now they're merged together, and some people are saying, hey, wait a minute, isn't this an antitrust issue too? What do you think?
Yeah, I think in many ways, you know, the merger, although the parties aren't characterizing as this, they're clearly joining forces. And as I understand it, the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund is going to put, you know, $2 to $3 billion in the pot. The chairperson who oversees that is going to be the CEO of the combined company. But yet the PGA Tour Commissioner, Jay Monahan, is going to have, you know, supposedly effective control there. So I think in many ways, you know, the settlement, the merger, whatever you want to call it, likely presents more significant antitrust issues than the litigation that initially the LIV players brought against the PGA for not permitting players to effectively play in, you know, the PGA Tour if they were, you know, signed a contract with LIV, and then that was subsequently the players kind of dropped out of that as plaintiffs, and then LIV was the plaintiff bringing that. So, you know, definitely antitrust issues, both sides, but I think there could be more significant ones based upon this settlement.
Yeah, settlement, probably a better word than merger, I guess, but it also speaks to the weird structure. You've got the PGA, which is a nonprofit, but I guess a pretty profitable one, and then you've got the major tournaments that affiliate only with the PGA, and now you've got LIV Golf. Could you talk about the structure and just the legal maybe weirdness of it here?
Yeah, it's I guess it's not been finalized, but essentially the world's major, you know, men's golf tours are now under the same umbrella and common ownership and control. So the PGA Tour, LIV Golf, and then also the European Tour. So that's the type of thing where, you know, does raise some pretty significant antitrust issues that the antitrust division of the Department of Justice is going to, take a look at. You know, we had three separate tours, and now they've been combined into an entity in which there is going to be common control. And it, from what I've read, it's the PGA Tour commissioner who is going to, be making the decisions as to, for example, does the LIV Tour continue to exist after the current season?
People may scratch their heads when they hear that the PGA itself is a nonprofit organization, which, of course, affects their tax status. Is that typical for a major sports league like that?
Yeah, that's not really uncommon. For, you know, quite a while, the National Football League was structured as, a nonprofit entity, which only would mean that the legal the legal entity, I'm not a tax person, is not paying the taxes, but someone else is. It would be, the clubs, for example, the NFL clubs. The players clearly are going to be paying income tax on their prize winnings. But tax issues are, one of the most significant factors that determine how a professional sports league or, association, for example, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, is, the legal entity itself, the NCAA, is structured as a nonprofit. So that isn't all that uncommon.
Talking to Matthew Mitten, professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University, looking at this big merger in the golf world, the PGA Tour, and this newer LIV or LIV Golf League funded by Saudi Arabian money. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, thoughts, reactions to the settlement, the combo there, 800-642-1234. Matt, here comes the Senate now, an inquiry here based largely on, I think, on the role of Saudi Arabia in this LIV Golf Tour. What are your thoughts on, congressional committee, a congressional inquiry into this proposed deal?
Well, that's not at all surprising to me, because this is the committee that's chaired by Senator Blumenthal, and it looks very closely at foreign investment in various industries within the United States. Of course, when, as you can imagine, if you get a foreign entity or funds, and typically whoever is providing the funding has control over certain, industries, ones that could be, critical to, let's say, U.S., defense. So they'd be looking very closely if someone's going to, acquire controlling interest in Boeing or any, military equipment suppliers. What's interesting about this is golf, of course, is part of the entertainment industry. And apparently this committee not only has jurisdiction to look at, well, what are going to be the effects on U.S. interests, but, which they'll look at. And they'll say, well, I've seen there's some concern that since there are PGA Tour events held on golf courses close to U.S. military installations. So that is a concern. And then also the broader issue of, Saudi Arabia's rather abhorrent, human rights abuses over the years.
Do you think it's likely that Congress will find grounds to enact laws to block or limit this new combination of these golf leagues, or that antitrust regulators would find cause to stop this deal from happening?
I think it's more likely that if this deal doesn't go through, or if there's some significant modifications required, it's going to be as a result of antitrust scrutiny by the Department of Justice, rather than any congressional action. I think there'll be some hearings, but you know, when it comes to Congress, it's, you know, the mantra after all is said and done, there's always a lot more said than done. I think that is going to be the likely result. I don't think we'll see any specialized legislation. You know, there'll be some, you know, the PGA Tour and officials, Commissioner Monahan, there'll be hearings, his feet will be held to the fire, a whole host of things. But because this is, you know, an entertainment industry rather than something that involves self-defense or another essential industry, I think less likely that it'll be resolved by legislation, perhaps more likely by some threatened, you know, anti-action taken by the antitrust division, or even maybe a lawsuit that could result.
We're talking to Marquette University sports law professor Matt Mitten about the PGA Tour, the big name in the golf world, merging with LIV Golf, which is a upstart challenger at first, and the controversy surrounding the partnership with the Saudi Arabian-funded sports enterprise. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Any pro golf fans out there, are you following this story? What do you think about this apparent resolution to the conflict? Do you have questions about the laws surrounding all of this or opinions surrounding Saudi Arabian involvement in a big American sports outfit? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Matt Mitten, professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University, with us today to talk about the Saudi-backed LIV Golf merging with the PGA Tour, some of the ethical, the legal questions that surround it all. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about Saudi Arabia's involvement with professional golf in the U.S.? What questions do you have about this deal? How would you like to see this all play out? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you're a golf fan, love to hear what you think of all of this. 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Mike is with us in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Mike?
I believe that Saudi Arabia, with their human rights issues, shouldn't be influencing or any other country in professional sports in the United States. They're just throwing a bunch of money in there, and I think the guy head of the PGA just took, obviously they gave him money and just took the money and ran.
Mike,
he did.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Matt, Mike saying doesn't like seeing that Saudi Arabian involvement, thinks the PGA head took the money and ran. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true. They made a business decision. You know, apparently it was costing, you know, millions of dollars to defend this case. They might have lost it. And when the opportunity arose for, you know, very substantial funding, then it shifted to, well, hey, this is in the business interests of the PGA Tour and its players. Kind of the idea, if you can't beat them, we'll join them. And the whole idea of, well, we just, you know, don't want to get into bed, so to speak, with a, you know, sovereign entity, this fund that really has this despicable record of human rights abuses. It looks to be just purely an economic decision that Commissioner Monahan and some others felt was in the best interests of the PGA Tour.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Matt, when this was all going down, before this deal was announced, you had some PGA players going to this LIV Golf Tour for big money, the PGA trying to stop them, threatening, you know, hey, you can't play at our gigs anymore. Well, now you've got this deal, and some players who stuck with the PGA, maybe turned down big paydays, might be scratching their heads. Could they potentially have legal recourse if the PGA doesn't sweeten the deal for them?
You know, I don't think so, because, you know, presumably these same, you know, the players who chose to stay on the PGA Tour had a choice. And, you know, they probably realized that they could have made a lot more money just in what are essentially appearance fees to play on the LIV Tour. But from what I've read is the players who stayed with the PGA Tour, they end up coming out of this okay, because there's apparently some consideration being given to them getting equity shares in this new entity, one, and that may well be substantial, because after all, if the PIF is putting, you know, $2 to $3 billion into the pot, that's a lot of money. And then the other thing is that the players who went to the LIV Tour, they'll all need to individually apply for reinstatement to the tour, and there may well be some financial penalties as, you know, a condition of reinstatement. So this could end up, you know, the PGA players who stayed, you know, might be close to the same position, or at least not any worse off than those who left for the LIV Tour.
Talking to Matt Mitten, professor of law, executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University, looking at this big dramatic story in the world of pro golf, a big money story with the PGA, the longstanding tour, effectively combining operations with LIV Golf, a challenger funded by Saudi Arabian-backed money. Still time for you to join in if you have a reaction or questions at 800-642-1234. Matt, we've seen questions, controversies in other leagues in the past when it comes to, say, the NBA keeping players from criticizing politics in China, for example, worried about offending a very large potential market for a sport. Do you see a difference between a story like that and a story like this, where it's not just, you know, worrying about a Saudi Arabian market, but being heavily funded by, in effect, an operation of the Saudi Arabian government?
Well, I think it all falls under the thing is that, you know, every professional sports league and organization is first and foremost an economic entity, and they do tend to look out for their economic interests. It's really the same thing here. It's, you know, kind of shades of the same color, so to speak. And, you know, there's always been an uneasy mix between sports and politics. There's never been a clear separation. We don't really have it in other industries also. There is, you know, Saudi investment in a whole range of companies. It just doesn't get as much attention like sports does.
This isn't, this is an agreed deal. There's a lot of things to be worked out, some potential challenges. What are some of the big questions you have, Matt, as these two, I guess three entities, counting the European Tour, hash out exactly how this thing is going to work?
Well, one we, you know, I mentioned already is, you know, one of the things motivating this is that, at least the PGA Tour wants to have, with its tournaments, the best players in the world, you know, participating on those. So they're going to have to, you know, work out what's going to be the process, what's going to be the economic penalty, other discipline for what, you know, Commissioner Monahan has said is disloyalty. You know, you agreed to play just for us, and now you're leaving. That will be an issue. I think the you know, the government entity conducting the antitrust review, the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, is going to want to know, well, are there going to be, are these three tours going to continue to exist, even if they're under common control? I mean, you know, there's going to be some serious antitrust concerns if this is just, well, okay, Saudi Arabia's putting a bunch of money into that's going to benefit the PGA Tour. I think the European Tour is going to continue to exist. But what about the LIV Tour? Is that going to go away? Because particularly is that a decision that Jay Monahan has the sole authority to make. And it might have been a thing, you know, where the marketplace decided, well, we prefer the PGA Tour over the LIV Tour, and we want to see all of the best players compete more in the format that, you know, the PGA Tour is traditionally done, where it's, you know, there's a cut made after the first 36 holes. It's why we typically have one major professional league for each team sport in the U.S. You know, what sorts of innovation might come about this? I guess there are some features of the PGA Tour that, you know, team golf, those sorts of things.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Matthew Mitten, professor of law, executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University, looking at the planned combination of LIV Golf and the PGA Tour, what it means beyond the world of sports. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin's alcohol laws could change under a bill in the state legislature. We'll find out what's going on. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll get a preview of music festivals in Wisconsin this summer, plus advice for first-time festival goers with a Wisconsin music writer. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.